So I'll assume that you read my paper, but I'll go very briefly about the main points, and then we can discuss it. And so here it is. My question is, how should we theorize about social justice within the city? And by social justice within the city, I mean redistribution policies that derive from, are initiated by, the local urban municipalities rather than by the state. So people's well-being is affected by redistribution, which derives from policies conducted and by and initiated by parliaments and governments, but also by policies initiated and conducted by the urban municipality. And this is what I refer to. And the first point I make is I ask why do we have to theorize about justice within the city? And of course, the answer is just like any other ethical theory, theory of justice must define its subjects. And distributive justice theories should first and foremost relate to the question of the beneficiaries of this distribution. And indeed, justice theorists have been dealing with this a lot. So we have theories about justice within between generations, and justice, international justice, and justice between species, and so on and so forth. So there is a point to make about justice within the city. And therefore, the first thing that we have to learn or look at is the kind of relationships that exist within the city and whether they are different from the relationships that exists within the state or on the state level. And my point, my first point is that they do differ significantly from relationships within the state. And then I use some research that I did with a colleague, Daniel Bell, who is actually originally from Montreal, and we studied together. Daniel Weinstock and I studied together and with Daniel Bell in Oxford. And Daniel Bell and I wrote a book, which is going to be published soon, "The Spirit of Cities." And there we interviewed a lot of people in nine cities in the world. And we asked them a lot of questions about their lives and about their expectations from the city and so on. And we realized that most people in contemporary cities feel that the cities are too individualized and commercialized, and therefore they want the municipality to correct this with institutional intervention. So they do expect their municipality redistributive policies to contribute towards sustaining urban communities. Which we define as the urban ethos that Patrick mentioned earlier. And then the next question what are the differences between justice within the state and justice within the city? And I claim that there are three basic differences. First is trivial, that different authorities play the game. The second is that the distributed objects are different. And this I do. This I support by analyzing budgets in many cities and in many states. And the third is that redistribution focuses on different goals, so that ultimately the function of justice differs between the state and the city. And the function of justice within the city, I want to claim, is fostering community rather than just allowing people to live together, which is the function of justice within the state. So I'll skip the question who distributes, because this is banal, and then I'll move to what is distributed. The state, of course, distributes a lot of goods, but mainly money through transfer payments, taxes, and salaries. Whereas when we look at, distributive policies within the city, we find that it's mainly services, education, culture, sport, sanitation, environmental services, and allowing special mobility. And you know, I analyzed several budgets, but the one that I give here is from Tel Aviv. It's around 50 to 60% of what they pay, what of the budget is spent on these services, and the rest is salaries to employees of the local municipality. So we can see that there are different objects that are distributed. And then the third question, which is the most important, is what are the aims of distribution? What are the goals of justice? And here I interpret the budgets. So this is the place where you can slaughter me that I'm completely wrong. It seems to me that, and here I'm saying something empirical, it's not that normatively I agree with this, but that on the state level, Rawls has got it right in the sense that this is what's going on in the world, and that the role of the principle of justice is to specify the fair terms of social cooperation, and basically not more than that. Again, I'm saying this empirically, descriptively, that this is the case. So the liberal state, therefore, is neutral in the sense that nobody expects it to reflect, let alone promote, ideas of the good. In the city, however, people seek something like a city identity, which is unique and different from other cities. And again, here I exploit the work that I've done with Daniel Bell. And the theme there, to put it in a nutshell, is that in the age of globalism, states do not differ very much from each other, ideologically speaking. So, you know, to be a French citizen is not that different from being a British citizen or a German citizen, which wasn't the case like 30 or 40 years ago. But people do want to have a particular identity. They do want to feel different from other people, and therefore cities rise as an alternative source of particular identity. If you compare the identity of, you know, being a citizen of Rome and being a citizen of Milan, that's, you know, a very different attitude to life, or Berlin and Munich, or Glasgow and Edinburgh, and so on and so forth, you can see that people shape their own particular identities through a city identity rather than a national or a state identity. So that's the theme in this book with Daniel Bell, and I'm using it here as an empirical claim that this is what citizens want. They want their cities to produce an ethos which is particular and different from other cities. But looking at it together, the claim here is that they're tired with commercializing life in the city, and they want to see something else, something on top of this, and they want the city to foster social cohesion or community in that way or another. Okay, so then in the paper I have a lot of examples of how this is done, but unfortunately other people here had better examples than I did, or fortunately. I think that Richard had very good stories that I could use in my paper. So I'll skip this and just, if you didn't read the paper, then just believe me. Okay. Then there is a section about how cities cater for the request for community. And here I'll go very briefly through the titles, actually. Cities sustain their ethos and idea of the good. For example, Montreal sustains its idea of bilingual and multicultural ethos. You can see it everywhere in the city. It's like shouting. Tel Aviv sustains its ideas. It tells everybody in the world that it's the gay capital of the world. Apparently, statistically, it's true. But I mean, they do have policies to sustain this. and so on and so forth. The second is that cities sustain accessibility and special mobility, and this, if you analyze budgets, you can see it very clearly. And the third, by paving sidewalks and fixing roads and so on and so forth. And the third is that cities invest a lot in recreation parks. And then the last section of the paper is something I want to. I have 5 minutes.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So I'll.
Right now you have.
Okay. Can I have six? No, I'm just joking. Five will be enough. I want to give an example. I want to discuss more profoundly gated communities and show why, in this case study, you can see that what you need is a sort of communitarian theory to explain urban justice rather than the liberal neutral theory. So gated communities, we all know what they are. They are parts of the city. In this sense, I slightly disagree with Frank's comment about gated communities, that they're not really parts of the city, or you didn't mean to say this. But anyway, they are a very important phenomena in the Western world and in South America and Central America and North America, and now gradually more and more in Europe. There are three types of gated communities. There are gated, or three sources or reasons why people have gated communities: lifestyle communities, prestige communities, and security zone communities. Now, I haven't seen so far, maybe I should have seen, but I haven't seen a neutral theory of justice which can explain why this is wrong. And the reason is that usually people say, look, it's a private matter. This goes back to Martin's papers. It's a private matter. People want to invest money in this. You know, we cannot say no. There's no reason to say no, et cetera, and so on and so forth. And I want to argue that, or at least I have an intuition, that gated communities do clash with the sense of urban justice. And the reason, I think, is that they clash with the idea of urban community. And I have four reasons why this is so. First, urban community, flourishes where there is a shared ethos, and as I said, and gated communities are all about excluding people from constructing the shared ethos or even defining it. Second, gated communities are part of the process of individualization because it's all about us and the other. And, you know, community is about seeing the other as part of what constitutes myself. But in a gated community, I see the other as a threat to myself, and therefore it goes against the ethos of a community. Now you could say that, so what? You know, you could have other people not being part of what constitutes yourself, but the point here is that it's all about institutionalization of this attitude by planning. Thirdly, some forms of exclusion are more harmful and destructive than others, and the point here is that gated communities exclude those who are already disadvantaged: single mothers, poor, and usually blacks, and so on. And the fourth reason is that gated communities distort the notion of community. You know, when you have a community, you have two elements in defining it. One is say inclusive, so what's coming to us all in the community, and the other one is what does distinguish us from others. Now, if you use the distinction as an empirical fact, that's okay. You know, what distinguishes academics from non-academics is that, you know, we are weird because we talk about these issues, or we spend a lot of time writing about issues which nobody cares about. And but if you say what distinguishes me from others is is that they are inferior to me. If you have a moral attitude, then this is wrong. So I guess I ran out of time, so I won't discuss. You can ask me. Yeah, okay. So 30 seconds. There are two challenges that can be raised against this argument of mine. And one is, look, it's legitimate crime. There's so much crime. So why do you care so much about gated communities? People want to protect themselves. And the point I want to make is that when you distinguish yourself from others and when you don't see them and when you don't interact with them, this only heightens such fears rather than solves them. And it will be an escalation of fears and hatred. And there's no point in doing this if you want to solve the problem of crime and fear of crime. And the second challenge is that, come on, people want to feel at home. You know, and people have a right to choose their own neighbors and buddies and friends. And, you know, you chose your wife by selecting her from others. So what's wrong with them? And again, the point is that, yes, indeed, in personal relationships, people have a right to do this. But when we institutionalize this through politics, I think this is wrong, because the whole point about politics is that it has to be based on equality of status. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, thank you for the paper, which I like very much. And I agree with so much of what you said at the end about gated communities. However, one of the presenters this morning said, well, when I say city, think about the metropolitan region. And I think that when we think about the metropolitan region, and we think about so many of the jurisdictionally distinct municipalities that are sort of like de facto gated communities, it highlights why, from a justice perspective, the provision and distribution of the kind of goods you're focusing on at the municipal level is so problematic. So for example, the provision of public education in these very sort of class and often racially and ethnically segregated municipalities. So I think that sort of normatively I'm with you, but empirically what I was thinking about, and I'm surprised because I never really agree with David Miller, but I found myself thinking about his argument that in fact people do identify and experience themselves as members of nations. And he says this is sort of his empirical argument, which I don't know if it's right, but he certainly cites a lot of evidence, is that this is like the highest level or the broadest level at which you can get people to identify, and it's the level at which we can actually have sort of redistribution oriented toward justice. So if you think about that argument, and if you think about the segregation of the metropolis, it would lead me to think that the kind of goods that are distributed locally ought to be distributed, you know, at a higher, more centralized level. So I like the spirit of your paper, but I was just wondering if empirically you're right, and if it makes sense to distribute those things at that level.
Okay, thanks. I should, Well, David Miller was my supervisor, so. I guess I'm offering a theory that will help us to criticize things. So I'm not sure empirically this is all right, but it is empirically based, but I'm not sure that this happens everywhere in the world and that it happens the same way in everywhere in the world. If public education is not distributed evenly or fairly or, you know, sufficiently, then this is wrong, of course. But then did you mean to say that that we should sort of extend the city to the metropolitan region and then to the state and then everything should be applied to the state as well?
So no, the argument was that, I mean, if I think about the metropolis that I live in, for instance, I live on a street where the first seven houses are in St. Louis, which has very poor, really terrible public schools. And the rest of the street, including where I live, is the best school district in the state, practically. So it seems to me that the logic of your normative argument should argue for a more centralized, perhaps metropolitan-wide, perhaps statewide, mechanism for distributing these key goods like public like public schooling.
I couldn't agree more. Just it is just that I gave up. I mean, we lost to the liberal neutralists, and they have it their way, which is what you're describing on the state level. So I'm hoping that we can correct it on the city level.
Well, maybe that's coming from a liberal neutralist, but I wonder what is the complete normative argument, because you claim that people identify with their city, and therefore that we should encourage this ethos, and there seemed to be something missing there, and I'm not sure exactly what it is. How do you go from the fact that people identify strongly with their city to the normative claim that we should encourage it?
Yeah, I knew it would come. Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's something that I have to work on. One way to answer this is that it's a democratic theory. So, you know, this is what people want. Why shouldn't we supply it, so to speak? The only reason we have not to supply what people want is if they want something which is bad. You know, if people want to kill each other, we shouldn't allow them to do this, right? If people want to have more wars, we shouldn't allow them to do this. But if they want something which intuitively is not bad, or at least, or even if it's good, we should allow them. But I absolutely agree that I have to work on this.
I have a lot of questions, but I'll pretend I only have one by mushing them all together, and you can pick whatever you like out of it. So the first question has to do with just the risk of a certain kind of romanticism in saying that cities have ethoses or ethi. Which, you know, I mean, if you, the example of Montreal is a perfect one. You, as a visitor here, said with a naivete, which a lot of people here would sort of, I'm sure all the Montrealers reacted to. You said Montreal is a bilingual and bicultural multicultural city. Those two words are anathema to a lot of people who live in Montreal. They think that it could be that empirically that is the case, but we should fight against that with all of our might, because multiculturalism is the strange disease that comes from Ontario, along with Stephen Harper, in some strange way. And it means people living in ghettos, whereas we should be intercultural, which means something different. And bilingualism is a slippery slope to unilingualism because of the context that we find ourselves in. And so we should really resist this. So one of the things, I mean, I read, as you know, I read your book in manuscript form, and one of the things that it was very evocative to me, but I wonder whether we couldn't save the intuition from romanticism by saying that instead of having sort of a governing ethos, we have something like a governing narrative. Now, regardless of where you situate yourself with respect to the value of bilingualism or the value of multiculturalism, it is the case, I think, that it's very difficult to live in Montreal without having those facts structure the way in which you live your life, be it as a promoter of them or as a reactor to them. And I was thinking of New York and ambition. You know, it's not the case that everybody in New York is ambitious, but definitely it's hard to live your life in New York without somehow structuring your existence around the narrative of, you know, the streets, the institutions, the air that you breathe, somehow being so the idea of a governing narrative strikes me as more sort of potentially pluralistic, and especially given the fact, and this is my hidden second question, and here I connect with something that I think Clarissa said, which is it depends how you define city, right? If you think of the city of Montreal as the island that we find ourselves in, you may have some claim to saying, well, yes, there might be a governing ethos. But if you define the city as the metropolitan area, you find people who have moved into suburbs and exurbs precisely in order to flee what they view as the governing ethos of the island, which is, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah. And so I think the idea of narrative, you know, so they're part of the narrative, right? They have fled to some degree, you know, this more complicated than just that, but they fled to some degree in order to find something different from the ethos that they see as governing just the you know, the little island that we have. So really two questions, you know, is there not a sort of fear of a kind of romanticism of a shared ethos? And also, as one considers the broader municipal area rather than just, you know, the city, wouldn't it make sense to go towards more something like a conception of a dominant narrative rather than a dominant ethos?
Okay. And would one of the differences be that ethos is more...
Yeah.
Right, okay. The way we use the ethos and the way I use it here is not to say that this is it. Rather, it is to say that there is something there and it's debated, but it's there. And for, you know, I'm a communitarian, not in the sense that I want to impose the community values on everybody else, right? I live in Israel. I wouldn't want the values of the majority of my population to be imposed on me. But still, I see myself as an Israeli in a very strong sense, partly because 90% of my time I debate these values and challenge them. So the same would be about the ethos of Montreal, right? I mean, okay, it's bilingual, and some people are sick with it or tired of it with it, and you know, and they want to change it and they want to escape, but they can debate it, and as long as it's there and it's debated, I think it's the ethos, right? I mean, and the same about ambition in New York, you know, or religion in Jerusalem, which is the main ethos. Now, I'm secular, right? But I still see this as the ethos of Jerusalem, and it allows me to debate it and to try to interpret religion in a different way, and you know, so on and so forth. So I guess in that sense, narrative would be just the same, although narrative is more up-to-date concept, so maybe we should use it.
Frank? Thanks to you, I was able to spend some time in Israel, and I spent most of it in Jerusalem and the rest in Tel Aviv. And any country that can have those two cities in it is going to invite exactly this ethos think that you're involved in. So I can, Benjamin, this isn't my question, but Benjamin, you talk of ethos and Daniel of narratives. Benjamin used the word aura. So we talk about the aura of a city, and as far it's a hard concept, but I think it's essentially an aesthetic concept, which reverberates to identities, and that the aura of a city is something that people in the city, or out of it for that matter, are either proud of or embarrassed by. And so anyway, that's another, something might be a little softer than either ethos or narrative. On the gated community question, the ones that are motivated by security are within cities, and they are motivated by fear. And it seems to me that what I said in answer to Patrick's question, I mean, there is something that fear is not the kind of, it's not like tap water you turn on and off. And fear has a reverberating effect, and it affects all of one's personality, sense of identity, and sense of others, and all the rest of it. And it seems to me that's what's wrong with gated communities, thus motivated. It's the fearful politics which allowed us to have a conservative government we now have. It's the fearful politics that allowed us to get this horrid mayor we now have in Toronto. They both played to fear. We've got to have mega prisons. We must have fighter jets. It's dangerous out there. You know, that sort of fear. So now with respect to the lifestyle communities, there I think that Sennett's views kick in, and it has to do with people's sense of self. Because I do think that one-dimensional people are very, very rare. Most people have multiple identifications with an ethnicity, with a worldview, with sexual orientation, age, class, all manner of things. And these don't, it's very hard to find a package that would be so coherent and so separate from any other package that it would kind of be satisfying to people that have that personality package, that self-identification package, to live in just one part of a city. So there might be dominant ones or very important ones, and that would lead them to congregate. And here's where the Richard Sennett's ideas, I think, are really important about walls, borders, which are porous and movable, both physical ones in terms of buildings and design and architecture, but also cultural ones, as opposed to walls, which wall people off from one another. And if whatever else a gated community is, it's a walled-in community. That's the whole idea of it. That's where I think it comes into play. So we have communities in Toronto that are largely Portuguese, for example, because that's a major part, but they feed into other communities around it, and they're not 100% there, and their exit is possible. And, you know, that seems to me a healthier way of looking at it than in terms of walls.
Okay, thank you.
So I thought your paper was very, very thought-provoking, because it really does give us a very distinctively city-centric answer to the problem of justice, and I thought also interesting insight or perspective into the problem of gated communities. Yet here's my problem. You say the problem with gated communities is that they clash with urban community, but can't we just solve that by upscaling and we have gated urban communities instead? Now, I don't mean literally gated, but metaphorically gated, institutionally gated, or, you know, through design cues, you have areas that are elite enclaves that function very much like gated communities, but they're at the scale of cities, and therefore they become justified because they promote, I think, a strong sense of ethos, a strong sense of identity, a strong sense of community. So I guess I see that exactly in criticizing gated communities, you're in fact maybe justifying or rationalizing something which is more insidious and really quite widespread in lots of places today. So I guess one response to that could be that you know, there's a priority of the fair over the good, or the equity and distribution at the level of state over the justice of the promoted by the cities. I was wondering if that was in fact your position, and also the arguments that you marshal against gated communities, couldn't those also be used against the idea of the city itself, if some of these cities are these elite enclave type cities, which are very common, especially in suburban communities in the United States?
So you mean like there would be a city which is metaphorically gated and doesn't allow people to live there?
Yes, so many suburbs separated from the central city in order to make sure they could use their tax base in order to pay just for their own exclusive public goods, like a good public school system, and not to have to finance those goods for others, as well as to have, let's say, you know, limit public housing. You have setbacks on the size of large lot size, setbacks for houses to make sure that you don't have rental housing, that you have large exclusive communities, and these places tend to often have a high level of, you know, solidarity internally and a strong communitarian ethos. As Herbert Gans told us, the Levittowners actually did have a really strong sense of community and a strong sense of ethos. So I'm saying, in the very tools that you use to criticize gated communities, doesn't that then justify those same types of strategies, but at the level of the city?
Well, it seems to me that it wouldn't, because, as I said, one of the reasons I criticize gated communities is that they are not based on the equality of status. And the equality of status seems to me to be the first value that we have to adopt in order to have a democracy. So unless you want to depart from democracy, and you're ready to accept an undemocratic system, which I think we don't want to have. If you're not ready to accept an undemocratic system, then it seems to me that there is, as you say, a priority of this value, the equality of status, and therefore, I think we have a tool, or we have a means of criticizing such a city. Am I not getting you right, or?
Well, I guess that would suggest that the concept of community is really not such an important fundamental feature of justice, right? Because ultimately the work is all being done by the idea of a universal equality of persons, and.
Okay, right. There are various notions of community, and of course there's this the conservative community, but I think the one I'm working with here is a kind of, if you want, a light communitarian perspective, or one which is based on universal values. Of course, only it stresses the, or it emphasizes the importance of having a community on top of these values. So again, the whole idea of community, right? Here it is in a nutshell. Okay, the whole idea of community is that one's notion of self is constituted by one's relationships with others, and by the others being part of one's self. Now, if we are talking about constituting your identity, we have to allow some criticism, some exchange, and therefore the conservative notion of community is completely wrong, because it doesn't allow change. It's based on tradition and so on and so forth. So for me, the notion of community that I have here does go hand in hand with liberal values and universal values. So, but still, it is a notion of community in the sense that there is this story that we tell ourselves about, a narrative that we tell ourselves about what's coming to all of us.
So, Avner, I like this idea of redistributing to foster community. I hadn't thought about it before, and I just wonder if the problem with gated communities is that they're fleeing redistribution or they're resisting redistribution altogether. I don't know if that's helpful, but I see a couple of problems or some difficulties with the redistribution to foster community notion, which is, the first is just the neoclassical view that, and this was raised before, that cities can't redistribute, that the state is the only one that can do it, and the reason the cities can't do it is because the rich will flee from the redistributive regulations that are imposed on them. The second is that there's redistribution, and I think that's overstated, actually, and we can talk about that some more, but I think that claim is overstated. There's another claim, though, which is that redistribution goes in both directions in cities, from the rich to the poor, but also from the poor to the rich. So you build an opera house in the city, that's from the poor to the rich. You fund public schools relatively equally, that's often from the rich to the poor. You provide transportation, public transportation, that's often from the rich to the poor. But this is connected with my first comment, which is at least one possible claim is that you're bribing the rich with the opera house to stay in so that the poor get some redistribution. One observation, there have been some studies in the United States that show that the budgets of big cities tend not to change very much between Democratic and Republican administrations. Now, again, I'm a little skeptical of that work, but that might indicate that actually the cities are doing exactly the same things. That is, they spend most of their budgets on education and security and some on infrastructure, and that's because that's the division of labor, at least in the United States, between states, feds, and the city. And then one last, so that might make it hard to actually redistribute to foster community. And then just one last comment, which is, if you're gonna buy into communitarian theory, you gotta kinda take the liberal and the illiberal. So you gotta take San Francisco recognizing same-sex marriage, but you also have to take Cincinnati passing an anti-discrimination ordinance for gays and lesbians. And they're both expressing values, and I guess the question is that okay? Is that consistent with, you have a robust notion of community, which may make one of those consistent and one of those inconsistent.
Okay, lots of very important points. Which, if you have redistribution within the city, the rich will flee from the city. We used to hear the same arguments about social democratic ideology in the state. So, and everybody raised the example of Björn Borg. I think this is Björn. He was a tennis player from Sweden who was asked to pay 105% taxes. And left Sweden. Okay, so there was Björn Borg, but most people don't leave their states because of taxes, and most people don't leave their city because of taxes. And we, in the previous session, I forget who of the two said this, but the argument was that it's very difficult to pack and leave your home to change the way, the place you live, right? And it's I think Martin said this, right? Oh, Patrick said, okay. So everybody said this. So, you know, yeah, maybe some rich will react by this, but I'm not too worried about this. Building the opera, you're right. We do have a few policies which transfer money from the poor to the rich, or I would say from the not very rich to the rich, because usually the poor don't pay taxes. But, you know, so the idea is that if you do this, you should educate the kids of the poor to go to the opera and offer them free tickets and subsidize the tickets so that, you know, gradually they'll go to the opera and love it as well. But you're right. I mean, look, the whole point about the welfare state is that, you know, it is as if we redistribute from the rich to the poor, but it's not very accurate. I mean, those who really benefit from the welfare state are the middle class, because they have cars, so they can use the roads which we pay for, which the government paves, and so on and so forth. No change between democratic and republican governments. That's very interesting. I didn't know about this here. I know that in Europe there are changes. But I'll be very happy to read this. And anti-gay legislation, I guess my argument would be that I would be tolerant to a wide variety of communities, except for those which exclude people from the community, right? I mean, so, and if you have anti-gay legislation, then you say, okay, bye-bye, you know, we don't want gays in this community, and this seems to me to be an obstacle towards having a real community. Again, it would be a conservative notion of community, but not a vibrant, lively community.
Thank you. It was a very compelling paper. I'm digesting it, and that I have two comments, really. The second one is one where I'm just throwing something at you, and I'm curious about your response to it. But the first one is, general comment on the bringing up of the gated community, which I think is such a bizarre concept in so many ways, and I'm glad that it's been articulated twice, that a gated community in the sense that there is a wall around with the security is just sort of the final step on what we have had for decades, if not 150 years in North America, which is de facto separate entities. That's, I think, a very important thing to keep in mind, that it is almost a dominant mode of habitation of human habitat in Canada and the U.S., more in the U.S., I think. The second thing is where and that's just a comment that I'm throwing out to the room. The second one is where I'm curious about your response about identity in the city. I did both of my graduate dissertations on self-identity and place and landscape, and approaching it from both phenomenological and a more sort of empirical social science perspective. And I drew upon work that had been done in the US, and I did it in several different parts of Canada. And although it is difficult to move house, because I do a lot of work on residential choice satisfaction mobility, people do it a lot, and especially in North America. High rates of residential mobility. And one way in which people maintain consistency and continuity of self-identity across the life course is not by self-identifying with Toronto or Chicago or Denver or Vancouver, but by self-identifying with a generic kind of neighborhood, an urban neighborhood with duplexes and lots of big shady trees. So someone who lives in Montreal will live in Mile End or Outremont, will go to Toronto, will live in somewhere like the Annex, will go to, let's say, Chicago, will live in an experientially similar neighborhood. And that has actually been shown in a number of different studies to be much more potent as an explanatory factor for why people identify with place than identity with a specific locale, such as Montreal. And this goes to Daniel's comment as well. We have, you know, within a metropolitan region, people repudiate quite aggressively the idea of being in Montreal. We have people on the island of Montreal who live in Westmount, just a few, and say, I'm not part of Montreal. And this is true in everywhere, and it is very dominant. So I'm just curious how you react to that. It's not a comment other than this is something that's been observed and quite robustly demonstrated empirically in Canada and the U.S.
Right, yeah. There was a poet who immigrated from the Ukraine to Palestine at that time in the beginning of the 20th century. And he wrote a nice poem which explained why he he longed to the Ukraine and couldn't bear the landscape in Palestine, in Israel, and he said, man is nothing but the pattern of his homeland landscape. I think this is beautiful. So, yeah. I don't know. It's an interesting... I mean, the statistics that I know is that those who move are usually upper and middle class and people, you know, white collars, professions, so academics, lawyers, whereas most people don't move. Most people live and die in the same city that they've been in for most of their lives. But maybe you have, well, even including
like Quebec is the most sort of sedentary people, right? Be born and live and die.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, I have to think about it. Yeah, it's a very interesting point. I don't know.
When one waits until the very end, one has many other things to say. I just want to say two brief things. I agree with Nick, but it opens another problem. The problem is, what do we do with the Hong Kong people who moved to Toronto? Where do they get this idea from they have to live in Markham, which is an emergent leafy suburb? How do we explain the Italians who've lived in dense cities and don't want to live in Little Italy anymore? And how do I explain my Israeli neighbors in Los Angeles, you know, who had come from further down the Middle East through Israel to LA, and aggravated my European Jewish neighbors who had lived there all their lives by parking their cars on the front lawn? So there's, you know, there are definitely breaks in those ideas about those landscapes, and they need to also be examined in an age of you know, globalization. So that was an observation. A second small observation is that in this discussion, it seems to be too much of a separation made between the city and the state. You know, we fall into the trap that Paul Peterson and Manuel Castells, the neoliberal and the liberal and the Marxist, have put up there for us, and we fall into the trap as if they were completely different animals, while in reality we should follow Warren Magnuson or Andrew Kirby with an idea of, you know, a sort of an enmeshed understanding of city and state. But that's a different discussion. The question I wanted to ask was actually to both Frank and to the last paper, which is, in both of those ideas of how virtue and justice and all these things come about and how they can be regulated and budgeted, the source of inequality, the source of what needs to be redistributed, actually falls out of view. In Frank's paper, more than in your presentation, you make references to Jane Jacobs and Richard Florida, and so this, I interpret this as a way of saying there are people who are thinking about economies, creative economies, or whatever economies one does, may or may not believe in the virtue of those, or in the possibility of those to create equality, but there is a hint that the political economy has something to do with what is being redistributable. Because if you go to the city budget at the very end of the process, you must admit that it makes a difference whether you look at the budget of Porto Alegre or at the budget of Zurich. They have different things to redistribute. And because the wealth that is being produced in Porto Alegre is different from the wealth that is being produced in Zurich, and it's produced by different people in different kinds of ways, in different modes of production. So how do we bring that aspect of the production of inequality back into the discussion about the production of justice or the distribution of just budgeting?
As a socialist, I'm certainly bored with you. The point is this. I think that if we've learned anything about the fall of egalitarianism, and it wasn't communism only that fell, the falling of communism precipitated the fall of the egalitarian ideal, of the egalitarian imaginary. And I think that one reason for that was that insufficient attention was paid to the culture that is going to support egalitarian policies. Egalitarian policies were forced on populations, too many of the populations, by levels of government. And so a good reason to favor a virtuous city, that is a city that has virtuous citizens, is that therefore you have citizens who will willingly be supporting especially the virtue of care, of egalitarian policies. So that's the reason for that particular focus. It's kind of reversing the one I used to hold, which was first equality, then out of that is going to fall the virtues. I think it's the other way around.
Yeah, I'll just say very briefly that I think it's a very, very important question, but it will imply a new paper. I mean, it's a huge question that relates to the production rather than to distribution, right? And it's amazing that very little has been written about it, by the way. I think Ian Shapiro has written about it a lot, but I don't know what to say because I haven't thought about it much.
Well, Harvey. Harvey has written about it.
Harvey, yeah.
Well, let's thank our speakers.